production. A new study finds 15,000 mining claims in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming are within 30 miles of a national park or monument. Bo Kicklis with the National Parks Conservation Association says it only takes 3 years to get a claim.
That's pretty fast when you think about the potential threats that are associated with mining, like impacts to groundwater and water supply for communities, wildlife migration and habitat, air impacts. You think about other public land uses like recreation and conservation and so forth.
He says the leases are already too easy to get even before legislation in the Senate, which aims to further loosen the process. He calls this a real threat to the protected landscapes in national parks and monuments. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 10th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Alexis Ponce, Kenny, Althea Billings, Isabel Charlet, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Israel's inhumane strategy is being tried again. The Amazon is on fire with horrific consequences. And the U.S. denial of student visas expands and foreign student interest in the U.S. declines. First, Israel's inhumane strategy is being tried again. Israel's defense minister has announced that its forces will seize large areas in Gaza, mainly a buffer zone in the south centered on the city of Rafah, in another attempt to get all the hostages back through a removal of the Palestinian population and elimination of Hamas. The military operations in Gaza are, quote, expanding, involving the broad evacuation of the Gazan population from combat zones, said Defense Minister Israel Katz. They will also include, quote, the destruction and clearing of the area of terrorists and terror infrastructure, and the seizure of large areas to be added to Israel's security zones to protect our fighting forces and communities, unquote. His statements came after the Israel military ordered the full evacuation of the southern city of Rafah and some surrounding areas. Clearly, what these moves mean is that the Netanyahu government is again adopting the far-right view to seize the moment and rid Gaza of its population. The more Hamas refuses the release of hostages, the more the pressure will mount, said Netanyahu. Hamas is only willing to release more hostages through negotiations. One hostage support group put the matter well, quote, instead of getting the hostages out in a deal and ending the war, Israel's government is sending more soldiers to Gaza to fight in the same places that they had already fought over again and again. A horrific example of the human costs of ongoing Israeli military operations in Gaza occurred late in March. Palestinian ambulances and a fire truck, all clearly marked with their emergency lights on, were fired upon by the Israeli Defense Forces in southern Gaza. A New York Times report says, quote, 8 Red Crescent personnel, 6 civil defense workers, and a UN staffer were killed in the shooting. Troops then bulldozed over the bodies along with their mangled vehicles, burying them in a mass grave. UN and rescue workers were only able to reach the site a week later to dig out the bodies. The Israeli Defense Forces at first denied the report, saying the vehicles were without headlights, uncoordinated, and transporting terrorists. But the Times last week published a video that contradicted Israel's account. The video was found on the cell phone of one of the medics. The IDF has vowed to thoroughly investigate the incident. Almost needless to say, when Netanyahu visited the White House on Monday, nothing was said about restraining Israel's renewal of warfare, which includes not only the attacks in Gaza, but also ongoing operations in Lebanon and Syria. The Amazon is on fire again. In an interview conducted by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists with Carlos Nobre, one of the world's leading authorities on the Amazon, the extremely dangerous situation of Brazil's Amazonia became apparent. He said that starting in the last half of 2023, quote, we had record-breaking drought in the Amazon as well as record-breaking forest fires. In 2024, we had more than 180,000 forest fires all over the Amazon, with close to 148,000 of them in the Brazilian Amazon alone. And the data show that very few of those fires were ignited by natural causes, such as lightning strikes. Instead, 98% were of man-made origin, organized crime, putting fires in the forest. The Amazon is at a tipping point thanks to drought and fires. What does tipping point mean specifically? Nobre explains, first, the dry season that used to last 3 to 4 months is now 4 to 5 months. The rainfall during this season is about 20 or 30% less, and the temperature is 2 or 3 degrees warmer. Second, the forest itself has become a carbon source. Studies have shown that in the southeastern Amazon over the last 15 years, some forest land has stopped being a carbon sink and has started to become a carbon source. And that's significant. Historically, forests remove more than 30% of all the carbon dioxide that we release into the atmosphere. As late as the 1990s, the Amazon rainforest was still removing close to 1 billion tons, and in some years closer to 1.5 billion tons of carbon dioxide. If this process continues, by around 2050, a substantial part of the Amazon's forest will become savanna. The trees will be degraded, releasing so much carbon that stopping global warming will be impossible. Rainfall will be greatly reduced, not just in the southern hemisphere, but in the northern hemisphere as well. Our third major story, U.S. denial of student visas expands and foreign student interest in the U.S. declines. The State Department isn't waiting for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to detain pro-Palestinian students in our streets. The Guardian reports, quote, a State Department cable from 25 March describes a new standard for visa denials based on a broad definition of what constitutes support for terrorist activity. The directive states that, quote, evidence that an applicant advocates for terrorist activity or otherwise demonstrates a degree of public approval or public advocacy for terrorist activity or a terrorist organization can be grounds for visa rejection. Quite an example of free speech for the world. Fortunately, the courts have so far been able to prevent the deportations of most of these students, and in two cases have ordered them removed from detention in Louisiana and brought closer to home for trials. How will the harsh treatment of those students affect future enrollments of international students in the United States? Prior to these arrests, international graduate students' interest in studying in the U.S. plummeted by more than 40% since the first week of January 2025. Study released in November by the Association of International Educators showed that international enrollment at American colleges and universities had actually risen 6.6% from 2023 to 2024 and 11.5% the year before that. The steep decline in interest in studying in the U.S. could cut billions of dollars from the American economy. In the academic year 2023-24, international students, most of them graduate students, contributed $43 billion to the U.S. economy. In other news, Trump entertains a conspiracy theorist. There are many ways to illustrate the chaotic state of American foreign policy under Donald Trump. The tariff wars, the insistence on buying Greenland and making Canada a state, the destruction of the U.S. aid program. Add to that Trump's openness to meeting with and taking the advice of a half-crazed conspiracy theorist who not only has access to Trump, but also can successfully push him to fire senior foreign policy officials. That is what Laura Loomer recently did, persuading Trump, who evidently did not need much persuading, to fire six top National Security Agency officials, including its leader, General Timothy Hogue, and its deputy leader. Why? Because in Loomer's estimation, these people were disloyal. Had they demonstrated disloyalty? Of course not. Disloyalty was assumed, based on Loomer's, you'll excuse the word, research, and her accusation that the former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, is a traitor. The bigger message here is that in Trump's second term, no one is around who might keep him from meeting with people like Loomer. The fringe has become the center for him. All it takes to get his attention is the accusation of disloyalty. General Hogue had no apparent opportunity to defend himself, nor did his many supporters in both parties get a hearing. Nor, finally, was any consideration given to what these firings might mean for national security work. As a New York Times writer describes the current White House situation, quote, "With Mr. Trump now more confident in his executive power and instincts, and bolstered by a team that shares his sense of persecution, there is no pretense that he can be controlled or managed. The door to the Oval Office is wide open, and seated just outside it is Natalie Harp, a former far-right television presenter who lives in the Internet's fever swamps and is deeply devoted to the president." Next, elimination of the U.S. Agency for International Development gives China opportunities. There are many examples of how closures of USAID programs affect developing countries. In Vietnam, for example, USAID helped clean up Agent Orange defoliation attacks, an important project in U.S.-Vietnam reconciliation. And in Myanmar, dwindling international assistance during its civil war led to more reliance than usual on USAID to groups advocating for human rights and medical assistance. Then came a devastating earthquake that killed thousands of people. USAID would normally have been able to respond with medicine and transportation, but could not. Instead, the U.S. sent $2 million in aid. China pledged over $13 million and sent relief workers. USAID also had an important presence in Africa until the shutdown, plowing over $6 billion into African humanitarian and development projects. Also gone is USAID to NGOs that conducted research on China, such as on the condition of ethnic minorities and environmental protection. This has been an astounding abandonment of a long tradition of U.S. humanitarian aid. Hungary withdraws from the International Criminal Court. The Viktor Orbán government in Hungary announced the withdrawal, saying, quote, "This is no longer an impartial court, a rule of law court, but rather a political court. This has become the clearest in light of its decisions on Israel." In attendance at this news conference was a visitor from Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, convicted by the International Criminal Court of war crimes in Gaza and subject to arrest. But of course, one authoritarian leader doesn't arrest another. Next, the Trump Tariff Watch. The scale of self-inflicted wounds brought about by Trump's tariff barrage is stupefying. One such wound is to the U.S. allies and partners. They are being asked to accept severe damage to their economies and still support U.S. security objectives. It's one thing to impose higher tariffs on adversaries, such as 125% on China. The China tariffs, which Beijing has reciprocated with 84% tariffs on U.S. goods, will be costly enough to our economy. But imposing high tariffs on countries friendly to the United States and worried about China's economic power makes no sense. Japan will have to pay a 24% tariff, and other Asian countries with close ties to the U.S. will pay 30% or more. They are all struggling to find a way to appease Trump and talk down the tariff rates. Vietnam stands out because in recent years, the U.S. and Vietnam have cultivated improved relations calculated to help Vietnam withstand Chinese pressure. Its economy has become an important part of the global supply chain. Now Trump has imposed a 46% tariff on Vietnamese imports. That will have a devastating effect on Vietnam's economy. The U.S. is Vietnam's largest export market. Vietnam has offered to eliminate its tariffs on U.S. goods, which run about 9%, in return for Trump's removal of the 46%. Trump said he's willing to talk, but let's see. Trump's economic advisors may think they have boxed China in by raising tariffs, not just on China, but on the Southeast Asian countries, such as Vietnam, that China may turn to as hubs for re-export of its manufactured goods to the U.S. Rest assured, however, that China's strategy will be to find common ground with its Asian neighbors in search of ways to counteract Trump's tariffs. Beijing is already in talks with the European Union to work out their trade differences in light of the common threat posed by Trump's tariffs. This is a no-win situation for Trump and for U.S. national security. Finally, two updates. In South Korea, President Yoon Suk-yeol's impeachment was upheld by the Constitutional Court. He was immediately removed from office. The Prime Minister, Han Duck-soo, acting president, will remain in office until new elections take place, which must be within 60 days. And finally, the U.S. and Iran will engage in talks Saturday, according to the Trump administration, which mischaracterized them as direct talks. Actually, we don't know the format or level of diplomatic engagement in these talks. As usual, Trump accompanied the announcement with a threat, saying Iran would be in great danger if a new nuclear deal can't be reached. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Daniel Hauser, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. We're here to talk about a report from that organization called Strengthening the Earned Income Tax Credit Would Boost Economic Security for Nearly a Quarter Million Oregon Families. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being here. So I want to get into what this report finds, but first, can you give our listeners a little overview of what the Oregon Center for Public Policy does?
Absolutely. Here at the Oregon Center for Public Policy, we're really focused on digging into the data, analyzing the policies, and figuring out what's going on in Oregon's economy, what's going on for the families that are working hard to put food on the table for them and their kids and keep a roof above their families' heads. So we really love to be able to analyze just census data, agency data, really dig into anything we can get our hands on to understand what the circumstances are for families. And we consistently see and have for our more than 20 years that we've been in operation, consistently see that the families who are struggling most are families who are, you know, often working full time but are unable to pay the bills. And something that's been a really clear trend in the past handful of years is that the costs for so many of these families are rising and are really challenging their ability to make ends meet. And so we at the Oregon Center for Public Policy are lucky to be able to dig into issues around the tax code, around how workers are treated in the workplace, around how economic security can be advanced to figure out, you know, not just how bad is it for families, what's the data say, but also how can we actually, as a state, move things in the right direction, right? What are the policies and levers we can pull to improve outcomes for families?
Well, let's get into this new report to sort of set the table here. What is the Earned Income Tax Credit?
Yeah, the Oregon Earned Income Tax Credit, it's actually a share of a federal tax credit. So there's this federal Earned Income Tax Credit. This policy, it phases in as you get earned income. So if you're working part-time, maybe you're making $10,000, $15,000 a year, you'll start getting the EITC. It'll keep going up until it reaches this kind of plateau. And it depends on if you're, you know, what your tax filing status is. It depends on how many kids you have or if you don't have any children. It's kind of a convoluted federal tax credit in that sense. But essentially, you reach a plateau around $20,000 to $30,000 in income, you know, earned income, which is like income largely from wages or some self-employment income. And then it phases out until you reach around $60,000 to $65,000. Is kind of the end of the Oregon or of the federal earned income tax credit. So it's kind of a trapezoidal shape with a phase in and a phase out. But fundamentally what it does, what the earned income tax credit does, is it's a refundable tax credit at the federal level. And so that means even if you don't owe any income taxes, you would still get a larger refund back from the federal government. And research has found that tens of thousands of Oregonians are actually pulled out of poverty by the federal EITC, and even tens of thousands of children are pulled out of poverty as well. So the earned income tax credit, even though how it's kind of designed is a little bit complicated, the bottom line on its impact and its outcomes for families is it puts thousands of dollars in families' pockets when they file their taxes every year. You know, we estimate that it's, you know, more than 200,000 Oregon working families benefit from the federal EITC. So what the state does, though, is the state's Oregon earned income tax credit just takes an extra little percentage on top of the federal. So let's say you get $1,000 federally from the earned income tax credit. Here in Oregon, you'll get an extra $90 as a baseline. And if you have a kid under three, you'll get an extra $120 because it's 9% and 12% of the federal EITC is what the state layers on top when you file your state income taxes.
So the Oregon Earned Income Tax Credit does have to be renewed, and that's something that the legislature is looking at this cycle with Oregon House Bill 2958. And your report advocates that it should be tweaked a little bit too, this Oregon Earned Income Tax Credit. How could it be improved, or where is that process at?
Yeah, so House Bill 2958, and we're really grateful to have a broad coalition of partners, lawmakers, and advocates pushing to make this happen. What it would do is it would increase those match rates of the federal EITC. So like I was describing, right now, it's 9% for sort of everyone as a baseline, and then 12% if you have a kid under three. What our bill would do is would bump that up to 20% as a baseline and 25% if you have a kid under three. So that would make a really significant difference in people's lives, just that percentage point jump up that the bill would include. So consider a family with three kids earning $30,000 a year. You know, they would get about $900 more from the EITC just on bumping up that that match percentage. The EITC also has some kind of, I don't know, unfortunate quirks. It's one of the joys of taking a percentage of a federal credit is that we end up with some of the failures of federal policymaking. So one of them is that if you don't have any kids, you can't get the EITC unless you're within the ages of 25 and 64. So put another way, if you're 23 and you don't have any kids and you would otherwise be eligible for the EITC, you won't get it. But you would get it if you're 27. If you're 63, you would get it. But if you're 67, you would not. And so House Bill 2958 also, thankfully, includes something where it'll just be 18 or older, kids or not, right? Let's get rid of that weird federal exclusion of young working families and old working families or older, and just ensure that regardless of your age, as long as you're, you know, 18 plus filing your own taxes, if you're otherwise eligible for the EITC, you should get it, right? And so we're grateful the bill fixes that inequity.
Which communities would be the most impacted by these changes to the earned income tax credit?
Yeah, the EITC is really focused on like low and middle income working families. So, you know, the bottom roughly 60% of Oregonians would capture pretty much the entirety of the EITC increase. So we're really talking about folks that are, you know, the median income, you know, a full-time minimum wage worker, folks like that would really get the most significant benefits from the EITC economically. We also were able to analyze, and I should mention that my colleague Tyler McInnes was the author and analyst who really dug into this. So when I say we, I really mean he dug into this data. And what he found is that the Oregon Earned Income Tax Credit, increasing it, would disproportionately benefit Latino Oregonians and Black Oregonians, right? So, you know, we estimate that about 37% of Latino Oregonians would benefit from the EITC increase, about a quarter of Black Oregonians would, and about 17% of White Oregonians would. So obviously really widespread significant benefits across racial and ethnic group from the EITC, but the benefits would disproportionately flow to families of color. We also found in the analysis that rural communities would also disproportionately benefit from the EITC increase. So it both of these are largely reflections of how like low incomes are distributed in our economy and in our state. But what it does, you know, mean is that an increase in the EITC would disproportionately benefit people living in rural communities. And in the analysis that Tyler did that you can find on our website at occpp.org, we actually have estimates for every county in the state of how many households would benefit. And, you know, the largest benefits are in the most populous counties, just sort of by nature of the numbers, but it's definitely disproportionately more significant in rural communities. But even considering Multnomah County, you know, more than 40,000 families would benefit from this EITC increase, sending about $12 million to working families just in Multnomah County alone. And that's per year.
With the tax credit, with this larger amount of refund, what do folks typically spend that on? Is that something that you looked at?
Yeah, there's a lot of research at the national level in particular on, but also some state-specific data on what people spend their tax refunds on, what people spend, you know, if you increase their earned income tax credit or their child tax credits, where does that money go? And the data is clear. I mean, the overwhelming majority of that money goes to people meeting their basic needs, right? When we're talking about tax credits for families that are on the brink, are really on the edge of being able to afford the necessities for their family, they spend it on those necessities, right? They spend it on housing, they spend it on food, they spend it on clothing, they spend it on childcare. You know, they spend it on the things that their families are struggling most to afford, which makes total sense.
I was looking at the Oregon legislature listing for the House bill, and I wasn't seeing a lot of opposition. Is there any organized opposition to this House bill and to this extension of the Oregon Earned Income Tax Credit?
No, there's no organized opposition. The most frequent concern we hear raised is that it's expensive, right? You know, the Oregon Legislative Revenue Office has estimated that it would cost around $65 million per year to expand the EITC as the bill would do. One of the challenges is that for every dollar we spend on the EITC is a dollar that isn't available to spend on other important services and programs. And so I think that's something that often comes up with people in the legislature who are thinking about how and where to prioritize the available resources. And, you know, we are grateful that there's also a lot of literature out there that Tyler even highlights in his report, where the return on investment of investing in the earned income tax credit is really significant. And we know that in the long run, families and children who have more secure economic circumstances, right, that are able to eat consistently, you know, high quality food and aren't getting evicted, that they're going to have better long-term outcomes in education and their incomes and their, you know, stability of their own families when they become adults. And so it's really an investment in Oregon's future by building on the Oregon Earned Income Tax Credit. And that's really one of the key reasons why we think it's a worthwhile investment for the legislature. Not only is it just a moral, practical value that we should be helping people pay their bills today, and we should be providing these tax cuts to these working families, but it's also something that'll return the benefit to the state in the long run too. So it's really just a concern around the budget that I think slows down these sorts of proposals.
What do you think are the most important takeaways for listeners to get from this conversation?
Yeah, I hope the listeners will understand how important the tax code is at addressing economic inequality. I mean, I think fundamentally, the earned income tax credit, you know, today routes hundreds of millions of dollars federally, tens of millions of dollars from the state directly into the pockets of many low-income working families. I mean, hundreds of thousands of Oregon families benefit from the earned income tax credit today when they file their taxes. So it's really crucial that folks understand, like, we can make a difference in people's lives really efficiently, right? You know, it's not like standing up a new program. There's not, you know, a lot of administrative cost. It's very administratively cheap to increase a number on a tax form. So I really hope that the listeners will take away that, like, we can make a difference in our families' abilities to afford our bills and to address rising costs by investing in the earned income tax credit. And that the tax code as a whole has a lot of opportunities for us to make things better for our families. I also think that, you know, and I'll say one of the other maybe downsides to using the earned income tax credit to address inequality is that you have to file your taxes, right? So fundamentally, if folks aren't out there filling out their taxes, then they're not able to benefit from from the value that these sorts of policies can drive into their homes. And so there's fantastic tax assistance groups in the metro area and throughout the state. Metropolitan Family Services has a program called Cash Oregon that folks can go and get help from a volunteer, have them, you know, sit down with you and help you file your taxes. You know, we've heard stories of folks who go in after not filing for a few years and are able to get thousands of dollars back on their taxes. So would really just encourage, you know, insofar as that's a downside, we are also attempting to address it. And I want to make sure folks are also aware that there's a new public option to file your taxes, to claim your EITC and your child tax credits. If you go to directfile.irs.gov, Direct File is the program, you can file your taxes. Many Oregonians, there's a little bit of eligibility restrictions, but many Oregonians are able to file their taxes publicly for free, secure. It's really an amazing, amazing new program that this is just the first year that we've launched. So I hope folks understand, you know, both of those takeaways. Number one is that the tax system can be an incredibly powerful tool for addressing inequality. And number two, that folks need to claim their credits, right? This only works if people file their taxes and if families are actually claiming the potentially thousands of dollars they could be getting. I mean, the federal EITC alone can be, you know, upwards of $7,000 if you, you know, per year if you claim it.
That was Daniel Hauser, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, speaking with me about a report published by OCPP. It's called Strengthening the Earned Income Tax Credit Would Boost Economic Security for Nearly a Quarter Million Oregon Families. More information is online at ocpp.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this